You're listening to In the Vault, a KPMG banking industry podcast series.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Liz Lamadou, a principal in KPMG's banking and capital markets tax practice. And joining me today is Paul Lorries, a managing director in our banking practice. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Liz.
And this is a repeat performance. You were here not too long ago, and we did a podcast about the agricultural loan provision in OB3, and we are back today because the IRS has issued some guidance. So we're going to talk a little bit further. This is the provision in OB3 that was IRC section 139L, and that is the exclusion from gross income for 25% of the interest income received by a lender, qualified lender, on a qualified real estate loan. And those qualified real estate loans relate to agricultural property. So Paul, we've gotten some guidance, and that is the IRS Notice 2025-71 that answered some questions. I think it leaves a few open still. So why don't we chat about that?
Yeah, that sounds great, Liz. I agree. There's some good information in here. I think there's a thirst for some more, but we'll take this as a starting point, and all very helpful to complying with this new provision.
Absolutely. We'll take what we got. I agree. It definitely helpful guidance to get us started. So let's talk through a couple of things. First of all, there's information about what is a qualified real estate loan. And it speaks to a lot of the amounts of the loan.
That's right. Yeah, it talks a lot about substantially secured by real estate and provides some different examples. There's one somewhat absurd example where the loan is only 10% secured by real estate, so therefore only 10% of the proceeds would qualify for this provision. Probably the better thing, Liz, is they provided a safe harbor. So that's always helpful for kind of a bright line test of what's going to qualify for the exclusion.
So that's right, Paul. The guidance says that only the portion of the loan up to the fair market value of the secured property at origination qualifies. So if the loan amount exceeds the property value, the excess portion really isn't qualified unless you meet a safe harbor, correct?
That's right, Liz. And the safe harbor provided was that the fair value of the property is at least 80% of the loan, which is consistent with some guidance we've seen in other areas over the years. For real estate loans with REITs and other types of guidance. So I'm not too surprised with where they came out with that safe harbor, but it is a very helpful starting point.
That's right. So if at least 80% of the loan principal at origination relates to qualified property, then the loan qualifies, the entire loan qualifies. So why don't we put a couple examples to that?
Yeah, sure. So if the loan's for 100, and the qualified property that secures that loan is at least 80, then it meets that safe harbor, and the whole $100 of borrowings qualifies as a qualified loan for this purpose. They did go on with a couple other examples, which I think are also helpful and kind of gets to what we hear from clients about cross-collateral, where if you add personal property to it, which is, you know, maybe machinery or livestock or something like that would be used on the property, that you can have those two together. And as long as the ag real estate is a substantial portion of that, that entire amount qualifies as well.
That's right. And I will note that the safe harbor is just that, right? At least 80% and you're good. That doesn't necessarily mean that something under 80% isn't substantial. They really didn't define what is substantially used for agriculture.
Yeah, that's right. That's where the example related to the personal property was helpful, but it was also interesting because it still fit neatly within their 80% safe harbor. I think the example was qualified real estate was 500 and the personal property was 50 for a total borrowing of 550. So at that point, the qualified ag real estate is still 90% of the total, which easily fits in the safe harbor at 80%. So, you know, the question becomes, since they didn't define substantially, if you were to go to a different example, such as the qualified real estate was 500 and the personal property was 200. So you have a total borrowing of 700. So now you're down to the qualified real estate is about 71% of that total. Is that still substantial?
And I think we'll wait for more guidance to see if there is a hard line or if it's just below 80% is always facts and circumstances. I will add, though, they added a little bit of information about the use of the property. And that is, if you have a residence on the qualified property or periods when the property is not actively used for agriculture purposes, like maybe it's seasonality or you're fallowing a field, that is not going to disqualify the property as long as it meets the substantial use requirement.
That's right. That guidance was helpful too, because it's not uncommon that a farm situation has a residence on what is often called the home property.
That's right. And then the guidance also states that minimal or incidental agricultural activity is not going to meet the qualified use standard. And the examples they give for that are a personal garden, backyard beekeeping, or if you keep chickens for eggs that you use in your household, they're going to call that incidental use.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, it'll call into question maybe some smaller urban farming types of activities, like you just noted here, whether those would meet the definition. And given this guidance, it would have to be a pretty substantial undertaking to qualify, not some of this gardening or beekeeping or just a few chickens for the household eggs, right? Price of eggs is moderating, so hopefully that helps with that.
So true. So let's talk for a second about valuation on the property, because even if we stick with the safe harbor for a second and say that the qualified property's fair market value is at least 80% of the loan's issue price at origination, then the loan qualifies. But I think they gave us some guidance around how to determine fair market value, right?
Yeah, they did. They talked about, commercially reasonable methods and often with farmland, it's about what income can they generate from the property in terms of expectations for crops on the land or, maybe comparable sales or something like that, if depending on what land is selling for in the area. But oftentimes, they're really focused on a discounted cash flow analysis, so they'd be more focused on the income from the property.
But I do think it was nice. There's some flexibility there in using any commercially reasonable method.
Absolutely.
And then if personal property is actually used in the farming activities, that can be added to the real estate value in certain circumstances.
That's correct. And that was similar to the example I walked through earlier in terms of what qualifies and how we would get to either being within the safe harbor or maybe get a little more clarity on the meaning of the word substantial for this purpose.
Yeah, it's interesting because they say that that can be added to the real estate value and the lender needs to hold a valid security interest in those items, but then it reverts back to needing to be substantially secured by real estate. So it's a little bit circular there.
Yeah, that's where I'm sure the industry will be looking for a little bit more guidance when they do cross-collateral. The personal property tends to be a little bit larger piece of it sometimes. In other words, put the real estate below the 80% safe harbor at that point.
Talk to us a little bit about the ongoing compliance for this, because we've been talking about the value of the property at origination.
Yeah, and so it's all about at origination of the loan, and then whether it meets these tests at that point in time. So the good news is that once those percentages are established and it's qualified, there isn't a requirement to retest thereafter. So as long as the property continues to be used in an agricultural capacity, then the interest and the 25% exclusion should continue to apply.
And that's good news. There isn't some annual or periodic testing period. So lenders can rely on that initial good faith determination from when the loan is originated. And that is unless they learn that the loan is no longer secured. And at that point, the qualified status is lost unless it's resecured within 90 days. The lender learns that the security is no longer there. They have that 90-day window to fix it.
Yeah, so that's helpful, right? Then there's a cure period. Once that comes to their attention, they get a period of time, roughly 3 months to fix that with qualified collateral again.
And then I will say that if a loan undergoes a significant modification, and that would be determined under 1001, then at that point, there would be requirement for redetermination of the property's fair market value.
Yeah, that's right. If a significant modification would occur, then everything would get revalued to see how those percentages would fall out.
And then how about if a loan is purchased like on the secondary market?
Yeah, so if it's purchased in the secondary market, you get some optionality there. You can still look at the date of origination values, or you can look at the fair value on the date that it was subsequently acquired in the secondary market. So I think that's helpful to give some certainty to lenders as well, and also some flexibility to make sure that it stays qualified.
Yeah, that seems fairly taxpayer-friendly to give the optionality there.
Yeah, I think particularly if you think about how the industry and M&A is picking up again, right? I mean, I think you're thinking about secondary market transactions, but it also could happen in an M&A context as well, where Target Bank holds qualified ag real estate loans and it's being acquired by another institution.
That's a great point, given the current market conditions on M&A. So, Paul, let's talk about refinancing for a minute, because if the loan is used to refinance a pre-existing loan, then it does not qualify.
Yeah, that's one the industry was not very happy about in terms of the provision and how that kind of kicks out certain loans on a go-forward basis. But, the government's perspective of it is meant to be stimulating to the economy, so they want it to be about new money. I guess the good thing is that they did clarify, as we would have expected, that to the extent there is new money involved with the refinancing, that portion of it would qualify. So by way of example, Liz, if a customer has a loan outstanding for $100 and they come in and refinance that with expansion to their operation, and now they're going to refinance that piece, but they're also going to borrow an additional $100. So now the overall loan is $200. The new money portion of that would at least qualify for this new provision, even though the refinance portion would not.
Yeah, I think that guidance was nice to see. We had been thinking that made sense, but it's good to see that in writing that we can treat it that way. The other part of the guidance that I thought was taxpayer friendly was that borrowings that increase the principal of a pre-enactment loan, so before this provision was in the law. So, and this would include amounts drawn after the date of the law on a line of credit that was established before. If those are new draws or new amounts that's increasing the principal, then those can also count.
Yeah, that was very helpful guidance. So particularly with lines of credit, if there was additional borrowings after July 4th, those will now qualify. So again, very helpful guidance that lenders should be pleased with related to that provision.
So to summarize, the guidance we got, all the qualification depends on it being considered a new principal amount, and it is determined if it qualifies based on the fair market value of the qualifying property. The statute didn't talk at all about how a borrower used the proceeds, but it was also nice to see in the guidance that they just put a fine point on that the borrower's use of the loan proceeds does not affect whether the loan is a qualified real estate loan whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly. Hard for lenders to keep track of every dollar that goes out with these borrowers, right, and how they use it. So that was helpful guidance as well, was focused on how the loan was collateralized And then what they do with the money is their own business.
That's right. And I guess the only caveat to that is unless those proceeds are used to refinance a prior loan.
Excellent point.
So, Paul, what are the next steps with this and what can we expect?
It's mentioned in the notice that this is the start of moving towards some proposed regulations that will be issued related to this provision. Comments are encouraged. This can be submitted up until about the 20th of January. And they will take that guidance into account for their work on these proposed regulations. They also posed several questions at the back end of the guidance about areas that maybe do need additional clarification. One of those being the coordination with Section 265, which I think is something the industry is very interested in as well. And then several more about some of the other definitions within 139L that may need a little further clarification.
And I think that highlights what this guidance doesn't cover, right? It doesn't cover anything around 265, and that is, of course, the interest disallowance piece of the calculation. And it really doesn't get into any of the meaty definitions like what is agricultural real estate or what is an aquaculture facility.
That's right. So I suspect there will be more to come, whether that's these proposed regulations themselves or whether they issue another notice before those come out. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out over the next several weeks.
I totally agree. So we will look forward to what guidance we see next, whether it's another notice or the actual proposed regulations. And we will have you back then to chat, Paul.
Sounds great.
All right. Well, thanks for joining me today. This was really helpful to walk through the notice.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Liz.
Absolutely. And to our listeners, thank you for joining as well. This is Liz Lamadou on behalf of KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. I look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks for listening to In the Vault with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.